Good day to you. This is Kathy Boughton, volunteer reader for Sunsounds of Arizona. I am going to be reading from The Week.
We'll start off with the main stories and how they were covered. Trump steps up battle with courts over deportations. What happened? President Trump this week demanded the impeachment of a federal judge who ordered a halt to the mass deportation of Venezuelan nationals under rarely used wartime powers, an order his administration seemingly defied by sending several plane loads of migrants to a Salvadoran prison. The president invoked the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 last week to justify the arrest and deportation of 137 alleged members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua. Another 124 migrants were deported under normal immigration proceedings. After advocacy groups sued to stop five Venezuelans from being removed under the act, U.S. District Judge James Boasberg issued a two-week block on such deportations and ordered that any flights carrying deportees be returned to the U.S. But three planes, one of which left the U.S. after Boasberg's verbal order, subsequently landed in El Salvador, where strongman President Nayib Bukele has agreed to imprison deportees for a $6 million fee. Oopsie, Bukele wrote on X alongside a laughing emoji and a news report about the judge's order. Secretary of State Marco Rubio reposted the message. Video shared by the Trump administration showed the shackled deportees being frog-marched by hooded guards into maximum security prison outside San Salvador and their heads being shaved. In court 2 days later, a Justice Department lawyer repeatedly refused to answer Boasberg's questions about the flights, citing national security concerns. In a subsequent court filing signed by Attorney General Pam Bondi, the administration blasted Boasberg for continuing to beat a dead horse by demanding details on the flights, saying his micromanagement amounted to grave usurpations of the president's powers. Bondi said Boasberg was siding with terrorists over the safety of Americans, and Border Czar Tom Homan vowed the deportations would continue. "I don't care what the judges think," he said. "We're coming." Trump called for Boasberg's impeachment, attacking the Obama appointee as a radical left lunatic. Within hours, Representative Brandon Gill, Republican, Texas, introduced articles of impeachment. That prompted a rare pushback from Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. Appeal, not impeachment, is an appropriate response to disagreement concerning a judicial decision, he wrote. That protocol has held for more than two centuries. What the editorial said? Americans won't miss the deported migrants, said the Wall Street Journal. But it's still troubling to see U.S. officials appear to disdain the law in the name of upholding it. The alleged gang members were deported without a hearing in an immigration court, much less a criminal conviction. Trump claims the migrants aren't entitled to due process under the Alien Enemies Act, last used to detain Japanese, German, and Italian nationals in World War II, and says we're at war with the gangs. But there has been no declaration of war by Congress. Deporting migrant criminals is a worthy goal Trump was elected to pursue, but he must work within the bounds of American law, or he will take the country down a dangerous road. The administration flouted a second court order last week, said the Boston Globe. It deported Dr. Rasha Alawiya, a Lebanese kidney transplant specialist, despite a 48-hour block order by a federal judge. Alawiya, who holds a work visa, was detained on her return from a visit to Lebanon. Customs and Border Protection officials said she'd attended a Hezbollah leader's funeral and had photos and videos sympathetic to the terrorist group on her phone, but insisted they were unaware of the court order. Let's hope they're telling the truth, or we're on a course for a constitutional crisis. What the columnist said? The administration claims it carefully vetted each Venezuelan deportee for gang affiliation, said Syra Ortiz Blends in the Miami Herald. But many families are coming forward to say innocent relatives were swept up in the dragnet. One is Mervin Jose Yamarte Fernandez, 29, a Texas restaurant worker, whose sister Hare was stunned to see him on the shared video. She said he has no criminal record or gang affiliation. "I'm in so much pain," she said. "I never imagined this country would cause so much harm to my family." "The long-awaited constitutional crisis has now arrived," said Corbin K. Barthold in The Bulwark. "The administration is arguing in court that the president alone gets to decide what counts as an invasion and who is an enemy alien. Add it up, and Trump is asserting an unreviewable power to seize any person off the street and lock them up in a foreign prison. The potential miscarriage of justice is staggering." "All this is calculated," said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. "Trump knows many Americans are outraged by the collapse of border security and gang crime and believes they'll back the deportations. And he's figuring this will play even better with his base if he casts Democrats and a Democrat-appointed judge as siding with alien lawbreakers. That's terrible legal strategy, but it may be winning politics, at least for a little while." "Every prosecutor understands one basic rule," said former U.S. Attorney Joyce Vance in her Substack newsletter. "A court order is sacrosanct. You can appeal it, but must obey it. If Trump violates that covenant, we no longer have a democracy, but a government that operates at his whim. We're now headed toward a showdown between a president who has rejected the rule of law and a judge sworn to enforce it. We are in an exceedingly dangerous moment for democracy." Putin rejects full ceasefire with Ukraine. What happened? Russian President Vladimir Putin this week nixed President Trump's 30-day ceasefire plan, which Ukraine had accepted, and insisted that peace would require the U.S. and Europe to halt all military and intelligence aid to Ukraine. In a two-hour phone call, the two leaders settled on a lesser ceasefire, a 30-day pause on attacks on power plants and refineries, plus a prisoner swap. The White House readout of the call said the agreement barred strikes on energy and infrastructure, and Trump later told Fox News, "We didn't talk about aid at all." But the Kremlin's readout maintained that only attacks on energy infrastructure would be paused, and that Putin had insisted the key condition to peace was a total halt to foreign military and intelligence aid to Kiev. In any case, a few hours after the phone call, Russia broke the agreement with drone strikes on a Ukrainian power plant and a hospital. Steve Witkoff, one of Trump's senior advisors, said the drones had left before Putin relayed the ceasefire order, adding he felt the Russian leader had acted in good faith. Trump also spoke with Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky this week and proposed the U.S. take ownership of Ukrainian energy facilities and nuclear plants, saying that would ensure those sites were protected. Over the past few weeks, while Ukraine was contending with a pause in U.S. aid and intelligence, Russia retook almost all of Ukrainian-held Kursk, Russian territory Kiev was hoping to trade for Russian-occupied regions of Ukraine. Ukraine suffered a further blow this week when the U.S. canceled funding for a program that documented alleged Russian war crimes, including the abductions of Ukrainian children. What the columnist said? "Putin has played Trump," said Tom Rogan in the Washington Examiner. "First, he kept the president waiting for an hour, laughing with Russian businessmen about his power move before deigning to get on the phone. When he finally picked up, he promised only the absolute minimum, a pledge not to hit power plants, and then broke that agreement almost immediately. The very same Trump who bullied Ukraine into painful concessions simply accepted Putin's refusal of a full ceasefire without complaint." "Trump did at least get Ukraine a bit of a breather," said Jonathan Lemire in The Atlantic. "Russia has been relentless in bombarding Ukraine's energy grid, and if those strikes actually stop, it would be the most significant mutually agreed suspension of attacks in 3 years of war. Still, the pause is also in Putin's interest. Ukraine has recently been doing damage to Russia's gas and oil facilities, and Russia, hobbled by Western sanctions, desperately needs oil income to fund its military." If only Trump could see the Russian despot for the aggressor he is, and not just toward Ukraine, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Russia has been a force for instability all over the Middle East. It supported the former Assad regime's massacres of civilians in Syria. To this day, Moscow provides aircraft for Iran and gives Yemen's Houthis the intelligence that allows them to target U.S. ships. Most Americans see this clearly. Three-quarters of them, including 69% of Republicans, don't trust Putin to honor a ceasefire. Frankly, neither Putin nor Trump can be trusted, said Kathy Young in The Bulwark. The two sides didn't even agree on what they said. Was something lost in translation? Did Trump have a senior moment? Did the Kremlin lie? All three scenarios are plausible. The only conclusion we can draw is that Putin doesn't want an end to the conflict and is simply dressing up his no as a yes, but, and that Trump won't do a thing to pressure him. Just how far the U.S. is willing to go in appeasing Putin is chillingly unclear, said Mark Champion in Bloomberg. Putin has broken dozens of previous agreements, and giving in to his current ultimatums would sound the death knell for Ukraine's existence as a state. Trump has already conceded key Kremlin demands, such as keeping Ukraine out of NATO, and Semaphore reports that he is considering recognizing illegally annexed Crimea as Russian territory. If we assume that he knows the first thing about negotiations, Trump's goal for these talks can't be a lasting peace for Ukraine or stability in Europe. Is the Art of the Deal author a bad negotiator? Or does he have some other end goal? It wasn't all bad. Elena Hershey, 53, was already planning to donate a kidney when she found out through friends that her high school prom date, Sean Moyer, was on the list for a transplant, but faced a 10-year wait. Although they weren't a blood match, Hershey enrolled in a National Kidney Registry program to donate a kidney to an anonymous recipient in exchange for a voucher that moved Moyer up the list. Moyer's wait plummeted to a few months, and he received a living donor's kidney in February. When Maximo Napa Castro set out from the Peruvian port of Marcona on his fishing boat in December, he expected to spend a month at sea. But 13 days later, he was stranded in the Pacific Ocean when his engine stopped working. He first rationed a month's worth of food and drank rainwater. When that ran out, he survived on cockroaches, birds, and a turtle he managed to catch. After 95 days at sea, he was finally discovered by an Ecuadorian ship hundreds of miles off the coast. He was treated for sunburn and dehydration and welcome-homed by cheering friends and relatives. Castro said he never lost faith that he would survive. He told himself, "I won't die because I have my children and mother." Carolina, an African giant pouched rat, detected over 3,000 cases of tuberculosis and saved thousands of lives in Tanzania and Ethiopia over a seven-year career. She was part of Hero Rats, a program started in 2003 by the nonprofit APOPO, which also uses the pouched rats to find landmines. Rodents like Carolina have such a keen sense of smell, they can detect TNT 8 inches underground, and the program has raised TB detection rates by 40%. Last year, Carolina retired to an enclosure filled with toys and treats. "I call it our Florida," said APOPO's Cindy Fast. Controversy of the week. Columbia University. Is Trump at war with free speech? "This really could be the end of the university as we know it," said Megan O'Rourke in the New York Times. After canceling $400 million in federal funding for Columbia University, the Trump administration last week ordered that the school make a series of drastic changes, including placing its Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies department under academic receivership to get the money back. Ostensibly, this is intended to rectify Columbia's continued inaction against anti-Semitism, but that rationale is highly questionable. Last year's campus protests over Israel's war in Gaza led to the resignation of Columbia's then president, the expulsion of several students, and the creation of anti-Semitism task force at the school. More to the point, it's hard to see how cutting funds for research into breast cancer and pediatric health will make Columbia's Jewish students more comfortable, but easy to see how that will advance conservatives' ambition to rein in universities they consider elitist indoctrination centers. A day after the cuts were announced, federal agents arrested former Columbia grad student Mahmoud Khalil, said Erie Sentner in Political. A green card holder with an 8 months pregnant American wife, the Palestinian activist had helped lead the Gaza protests. Now he is languishing in a detention center awaiting deportation, all for daring to exercise his free speech rights by peacefully protesting. Like his alma mater, Khalil's fate is in the hands of right-wing ideologues who have declared war on higher education. Americans tolerate a lot of dissent, said Dan McLaughlin in National Review, but Khalil's behavior went beyond mere expression of opinion when he acted as a lead negotiator for pro-Hamas protesters who stormed Columbia buildings and engaged in targeted harassment of Jewish students. U.S. laws allows for the deportation of visa and green card holders whose presence in the U.S. could have serious adverse foreign policy consequences. And Khalil and other pro-Palestinian agitators meet that definition perfectly because American universities and the safe environment they offer foreign students, including Israeli Jews, are a valuable tool of our public diplomacy. As for Columbia, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, that lost $400 million is important discipline for an institution that too long chose to coddle anti-Semites rather than protect Jewish students. This has nothing to do with protecting Jews, said Jonathan Chait in The Atlantic. Trump presides over a political movement in which accidental Nazi salutes now happen with disturbing frequency, and grotesque anti-Semites like Andrew Tate and Candace Owens enjoy prominence and legitimacy. This supposed war against Jew hatred is simply a pretext for Trump's authoritarian crackdown on free speech. The attack on due process is just as serious, said David French in the New York Times. Just as the administration refused to let Khalil have a privileged conversation with his lawyer until it was ordered to do so by a judge, the White House also ignored Columbia's legal right to challenge its loss of funding in court. The university is patient zero in an outbreak of censorship and repression, and don't kid yourself that it will stop with Columbia. If Americans are going to resist, it has to happen now, said Adam Sewer in The Atlantic. Foreign-born activists and snooty academics don't make for sympathetic victims, and that's the point. Trump knows if we accept that free speech and due process are optional for this category of people or that one, he can then strip those rights from all of us. And we likely won't notice until it's too late. Only in America. Oklahoma's Board of Education has approved new social studies standards directing high school students to identify discrepancies in 2020 election results. The standards cite President Trump's debunked claims about mail-in ballot fraud and the sudden halting of ballot counting in swing state cities. State Superintendent Ryan Walters said the standards do not support or negate a specific outcome and are merely intended to help teach kids to think for themselves. Officials in Florida's Miami-Dade County are considering a bill that would rename 24 streets with the titles of local rap anthems. Commissioner Keon Hardeman, the bill's sponsor, says names like Grind With Me Terrace will boost tourism while honoring local music heroes. Commissioner Danielle Cohen Higgins said the plan could hurt property values, adding, I don't want Back That Ass Up Boulevard anywhere in Miami-Dade. It was a good week for homecomings after a SpaceX capsule carrying NASA astronauts Suni Williams and Butch Wilmore, whose International Space Station mission was extended from 8 days to 9 months because of technical problems with the Boeing spacecraft, splashed down in the waters off Florida and was quickly surrounded by a pod of curious dolphins. It was a good week for keepsakes. after White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt rejected a suggestion by French lawmaker Raphael Glucksmann that the U.S. marks its slide into autocracy by returning the Statue of Liberty to France. "Absolutely not," said Leavitt. "It's only because of the United States of America that the French are not speaking German right now." It was a good week for Donald Trump, who for at least the second year in a row claimed to have won the annual golf championship at his club in Palm Beach, Florida. "Such a great honor," Trump, 78, wrote on social media. "Such fun." It was a bad week for husbands, after Polish researchers concluded that getting married triples obesity rates among men, but has no equivalent effect on women. Katherine Jenner of Britain's Obesity Health Alliance said the disparity could reflect a male predisposition to increased portion sizes, social eating, and a decline in physical activity after getting hitched. It was a bad week for Justin Eichhorn after the Minnesota state senator introduced a bill to recognize Trump derangement syndrome as a mental illness and, just hours later, was arrested for trying to solicit a 17-year-old girl for prostitution. "Justin has a difficult road ahead," said state GOP Senate leadership. It was a bad week for scamps after a UK petition to ban slingshots passed the 10,000 signature mark, obligating the government to respond. Organizer Danny Rogers says the ban is needed because of attacks on humans and infrastructure, and warned that the assailants may ramp up their targets. In other news, Social Security cuts phone service for many beneficiaries. The Social Security Administration this week announced a change that could make it harder for many recipients to apply for benefits. From March 31st, people who want to file for benefits or change the bank where their payments will be deposited will no longer be able to do so by phone and must first verify their identity online or in person at a field office. The Trump administration said the policy change is needed to combat fraudulent activity. Advocates note that many older or disabled beneficiaries may struggle with online services or have difficulty in traveling to an office. Dozens of them are being shuttered. The new ID system could lead to as many as 85,000 extra in-person visitors a week to field offices, where the average current wait time for an appointment is longer than a month. Wait times could climb even higher if the agency pushes ahead with announced plans to cut 12% of its workforce. Turning now to the U.S. at a glance, Washington, D.C., DOGE fight. The Trump administration this week suffered a string of courtroom setbacks in its campaign to dismantle Washington agencies and cut the federal workforce. U.S. District Judge Theodore D. Chong ruled that Elon Musk and his Department of Government Efficiency likely violated the Constitution in multiple ways by trying to gut the U.S. Agency for International Development, the first instance of a judge directly attempting to curb Musk's actions. 26 current or recently fired USAID workers sued Musk and DOGE, and Chang's decision was based on the fact that Musk is not a government official formally appointed by President Trump. The administration also moved to rehire at least 24,000 probationary employees from 18 federal agencies after judges in two cases ruled the firings illegal. Most of the rehired employees, however, were placed on paid administrative leave. Another federal judge, Anna Reyes, blocked the Pentagon from instituting Trump's order banning transgender Americans from the military, writing that the ban was soaked in animus. Despite the rulings, the administration plowed ahead with aggressive cuts. With the help of the FBI, local police, and the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia's office, DOGE this week staged a takeover of the U.S. Institute of Peace, a 600-employee independent agency that helps resolve international conflicts and receives funding from Congress. During the showdown, DOGE removed the Institute's president, emptied its building, and installed a new leader, citing Trump's February executive order demanding the Institute cut its staff to the minimum required by law. The organization plans to sue the administration. This was an illegal takeover by elements of the executive branch of a private, nonprofit corporation, said ousted President George Moose. In Lincoln Heights, Ohio, Neighborhood Watch. Armed volunteers have been patrolling the streets of a majority black community near Cincinnati following a neo-Nazi rally last month that left residents skeptical of local law enforcement. The Lincoln Heights Safety and Watch Program formed in February, shortly after demonstrators who were carrying rifles shouted racial slurs and waved swastika flags from an overpass near Lincoln Heights, a town of about 3,000, that was founded as an enclave for black families in 1923. Residents of the village criticized the limited police response, in which there were no arrests. "What I don't understand is how I can be standing here in America in 2025 and somebody can walk up to my window with a swastika and have guns and call me the N-word and law enforcement watch," said Eric Ruffin, a local business owner. Hamilton County Sheriff Charmaine McGuffey said that the armed watch was legal, but it could make any confrontations more complex for law enforcement. "The unknown," she said, "is who else is armed." The world at a glance. Paris. Boycotting U.S. weapons. French President Emmanuel Macron is urging allies to quit buying U.S. warplanes, tanks, and weapons and switch to European-made alternatives. Those who buy Patriot missiles should be offered the new generation Franco-Italian SAMP/T, he said last week. Those who buy the F-35 should be offered the Rafale, a French jet. Macron's push comes after President Trump cast doubt on the strength of the NATO alliance, by threatening not to defend NATO members and repeating Russian propaganda. This month, Belgium and the Netherlands said they would go ahead with plans to buy American-made F-35 stealth fighter jets, but Canada and Portugal said they were reconsidering decisions to replace their old F-16s with F-35s, saying they could no longer count on the U.S. to service the planes or update the crucial software. From Lima, soldiers in the streets. Peruvian President Dina Boluarte declared a state of emergency in Lima this week and deployed soldiers to help police counter a surge of deadly criminal violence, including murders and extortion attacks. The decree came just a day after a popular singer, Paul Flores, 39, was shot dead on the tour bus used by his cumbia brand, Armania 10. The band had reportedly been targeted by an extortion racket. The murder rate in the Peruvian capital has reached a record high, with more than 450 people killed from January 1st to March 16th, and more than 1,900 extortion cases reported in January alone. Under the 30-day state of emergency, soldiers may help police combat crime and are empowered to enter homes and detain people without a warrant. People. Sheen's gift of giving. Michael Sheen is a hometown hero twice over, said Ermine Sainer in The Guardian, UK. The Frost Nixon and Good Omens actor is one of the most famous sons of Port Talbot, a former industrial hub in South Wales, where 30% of residents now live in poverty. After finding success in Hollywood, Sheen decided a decade ago to move back to Port Talbot and to dedicate much of his time to charity. One of his first projects was leading nearby Cardiff's 2019 bid to host the Homeless World Cup. When funding fell through, he sold his houses in Los Angeles and Wales to pay for it. "At first, I thought it was the end of everything. I was in massive debt. I'm still paying it off." But he soon began to view the experience as liberating because I realized I had a safety net. He was in demand as an actor and had easy access to low-interest credit, unlike most people in Port Talbot. That led to his latest project, spending £100,000, about $130,000, to buy up and cancel £1 million of debt owed by 900 low-income locals. Sheen knows people are questioning his motives for the giveaway, which is documented in a new TV series. "I'm not doing it because I want people to think I'm great. I want us to be able to imagine an alternative to the current system, because this doesn't work." Fielding's morbid humor. Helen Fielding has learned to laugh through tragedy, said Julia Llewellyn Smith in The Times, UK. In 2016, her ex-partner, Emmy-winning Simpsons writer Kevin Curran, father of her now 20-year-old son and 18-year-old daughter, died at age 59 after a long illness. We have a saying in our family, don't get too #deathy, says the Bridget Jones author, 66. I'm always reluctant to be too personal, but the children's father did die, and he wrote for The Simpsons, so no joke was too dark to make. That made me see you don't have to sit around feeling sorry for your loss. Moments of black comedy arose as she tried to navigate grief with her young kids. Children have this way. They'll suddenly say, why can't we live in a normal family like Vikram? And it's like a dagger to the heart, thinking, yes, Vikram's got a daddy. But no, it's because Vikram is allowed to play Minecraft during the week. Or they'll suddenly say, Mommy, where is Dada? And you're like, wait, we were just talking about video game points. Despite the heartache and pain, she thinks her kids turned out all right. They're quite emotionally intelligent. I don't want to pretend it's all perfect, but I honestly really enjoy them. How Movies Rescued Ricci. Unlike many of her Hollywood peers, Christina Ricci has no regrets about becoming a child actor, said Rosemary Rosemary in Variety. She made her screen debut at age 9 in Mermaids, 1990, and won worldwide fame playing Wednesday in the Addams Family movies. From the time I was very young, I always felt completely comfortable in front of a camera, says Ricci, now 45. At home, it was a different story. She has described her father, with whom she cut ties at 15, as a failed cult leader who was physically violent. Movies rescued me from a childhood that was not very nice and a family that was not very safe. She was spared the most heinous aspects of being a child in the movie business. Nobody tried to take advantage of me sexually. I was exposed to a few jerks, but I understood it had nothing to do with me. The industry's beauty standards, though, did erode her self-worth. On screen test days, everyone would look at me and talk about what was wrong. We can't shoot her from this side. Those kinds of things I did not enjoy. Still, acting was better than almost anything else in her life. To do this thing where I was totally safe when I was getting validation from adults and it was based on a skill that I had that was special, I think really, really saved me. In the news, Ben Affleck might be trying to win back ex-wife Jennifer Garner, reports the New York Post. Talk of a reunion between the two, who were married from 2005 to 2018, began earlier this month after paparazzi caught Affleck, 52, tightly hugging Garner, 47, at their son's 13th birthday party. A source said that Affleck would love another chance with Garner now that he's finalized his divorce from his most recent ex-wife, Jennifer Lopez. Images of the pair's embrace reportedly led Garner's longtime boyfriend, California burger magnate John Miller, 47, to warn her that he'll walk away if he sees anything like that again, said an insider. But a source close to Garner suggests Miller has nothing to worry about because she has no interest in getting back together with Affleck. Who wants the guy? The source said. You think he's the prize? No way. Kim Kardashian is considering changing a custody agreement with ex-husband Kanye West after he released a new song that features their 11-year-old daughter, Northwest, alongside accused sex trafficker Sean Diddy Combs. The track, Lonely Roads Still Go to Sunshine, begins with Diddy thanking West over the phone for his ongoing support as he remains in jail, awaiting trial on numerous charges. North can then be heard rapping, "When you see me shining, then you see the light." Kardashian took legal action to stop the song from being released, but a defiant West published the song on social media, declaring men make the final decision. He is now demanding that Kardashian remove the trademark she holds over their daughter's name. Amend it or I'm going to war, West texted her, according to screenshots the rapper posted on X, and neither of us will recover from the public fallout. Meryl Streep and Martin Short have been a couple for more than a year, an inside source told the New York Post last week. The Only Murders in the Building co-stars have been spotted out and about together in Los Angeles and New York City in recent months, most recently attending a Broadway show and a Saturday Night Live taping, leading to speculation that they were an item. Short, 74, denied the rumors, claiming he and Streep, 75, are just very close friends. But a source told the Post that the pair unexpectedly fell in love on the set of Only Murders in 2023. Meryl couldn't help but fall for Martin, the source added. She loves being around him. Best columns, the U.S. The U.S.'s reputation is ruined. David Brooks, The New York Times. Thanks to Donald Trump, America's whole reputation is shot, said David Brooks. Our nation spent a century cultivating strong alliances with other democracies, but Trump has smashed those relationships to smithereens. Over the past 2 months, the president has divorced America from the era of superpower peace by virtually ending our defense commitment to Europe, launching a culture war against Western liberalism, and slapping punishing tariffs on our European and North American allies. In shock and revulsion, they now see that America, the nation they thought was their friend, is actually a rogue superpower, a Judas whose leader is aligning the U.S. with Vladimir Putin's Russia. Our spurned allies no longer blame Trump alone, since Americans reelected him and thus chose to abandon our ideals. Europeans are now reorganizing their defense programs, knowing that U.S. support for NATO is effectively over. China will inevitably exploit our isolationism. As America betrays its friends, China will seek to make them. At some point, Trumpian incompetence will provoke a counter-reaction, and Americans may again recognize that our alliances with other free nations are actually the source of America's long-term might. Our own cultural revolution, Fareed Zakaria, The Washington Post. President Trump is launching America's version of China's cultural revolution, said Fareed Zakaria. To marginalize intellectuals, academics, and scientists, his administration is slashing billions in federal research grants in a dramatic assault on universities, which threatens to undermine one of our greatest competitive edges. Before he became vice president, J.D. Vance told an audience of conservatives that professors are the enemy and that we have to honestly and aggressively attack the universities, a view later echoed in Project 2025. That corrosive campaign is now underway, and it resembles nothing so much as the early days of the Cultural Revolution. That's when Mao Zedong shut down China's university and sent professors out to the rice fields and factories. The Trump administration is now making deep cuts in the federal funding for scientific and medical research, which helped create America's longstanding dominance in higher education. After losing $800 million in federal grants, Johns Hopkins University has laid off over 2,000 employees. Meanwhile, China is increasing research funding so that it could lead the world in science in the 21st century. In that critical competition, America is unilaterally surrendering. Why Trump Wants to Annex Canada, Michael A. Cohen, MSNBC.com. Nearly everyone assumes President Trump is just trolling Canada when he talks about turning our northern neighbor into the 51st state, said Michael A. Cohen. But he's been insisting on this nutty notion for months now, and his White House press secretary, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio have now joined him in urging Canada to consider joining the U.S. We're all too dumbfounded to acknowledge it, but Trump is serious about annexing Canada. He believes a punishing trade war will force Canadians to surrender their sovereignty, and reportedly told former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau that the 1908 treaty finalizing the border between the two countries must be revised. But why is Trump doing this? He wants to go down in history as a pivotal president who vastly expanded U.S. territory to include Canada and, yes, Greenland. Trump recently hung in the Oval Office a portrait of President James K. Polk, a champion of America's manifest destiny, who vastly expanded the country through war and annexation. Trump's obsessive threats to annex Canada and Greenland aren't a negotiating ploy. He wants these countries as trophies to satisfy his narcissistic needs. It must be true. I read it in the tabloids. A peaceful day of fishing turned into chaos for three New Zealand men when a leaping 900-pound dolphin crash-landed into their boat and went berserk. "One minute, everything was fine," said boat owner Dean Harrison. "And then just like lightning striking, there's a big dolphin in our boat thrashing around and breaking everything." As the three fishermen clung to the sides of the vessel, the powerful dolphin's flailing snapped every single fishing rod we had and severely damaged the bow, Harrison said. They finally took the creature to port and, with some help, returned him to the sea. A Canada goose held off an attack by a bald eagle in Ontario in a battle one witness saw as a political metaphor. Canadian Mervyn Sequeira, 74, photographed the 20-minute struggle between the goose and America's national bird and was surprised to see the feisty goose fight off the formidable raptor. "We thought it was over for the goose," Sequeira said. But strangely, the bald eagle just gave up and left. Amid the trade war that the U.S. has started with Canada, he said he found the Canada goose's victory very symbolic. China's latest hot pot chain has offered cash compensation to 4,000 customers after two drunken teenagers were videotaped urinating into their hot pot's broth. The Haidi Lao restaurant chain announced it had thrown out all hot pot equipment at that Shanghai restaurant and would refund customers 10 times the amount of their bill. "We fully understand that the distress caused to our customers by this incident cannot be fully compensated for by any means," the company said. Best columns, Europe. How they see us. Making Trump regret those wine tariffs. "Hands off our bubbles," said Emmanuel Beretta in Le Point, France. President Donald Trump has once again drawn his favorite weapon, massive tariffs, and threatened that if the European Union doesn't rescind its 50% tariff on American whiskey, set to take effect next month, the United States will hit EU countries with a 200% tariff on wine and spirits. "The entire world is ripping us off," Trump bellowed on social media. Never mind that European leaders only imposed their liquor tax to answer Trump's 25% tariff on steel and aluminum. Endless retaliation will hurt everyone, of course. But if Trump insists on playing this game, we have no choice but to match him move for move to show that Europe will no longer let itself be trampled. We have options, for example, targeted customs duties or import-export restrictions. And if Trump hits our precious champagne, we can wallop back against American drinks like Coca-Cola. Remember, Mr. President, shaking the bottle too much sometimes sends the cork flying into your face. "Trump's trade war is a ticking time bomb," said Solveig Goodluck and Richard Haut in Les Echos, France. "It will truly explode on April 2nd when he imposes duties on specific imports, including microchips, lumber, cars, and pharmaceuticals, as well as reciprocal tariffs on thousands of other items. He's trying to force Europe to lower its value-added tax, which he considers a trade barrier, even though it's seldom been treated as such in world trade talks, and to lower its taxes on digital giants. If Trump does what he has threatened, he will set fire to an international system that has worked well for decades. It's idiocy. Yet here we are again, fighting stupid with more stupid," said Jacob Hanke-Wehle in Handelsblatt, Germany. In Trump's first term, the then head of the EU, Jean-Claude Juncker, admitted that retaliatory tariffs to answer Trump's steel tariffs were a dumb idea, but concluded, "We can be that stupid. We have to be that stupid." Trump needs to learn that others can respond with brute force as well. He can't continue his economic bullying if everyone fights back. "These Trumpian whims are already backfiring," said Le Echo, Belgium, in an editorial. "Prices are rising. Farmers are panicking. Businesses are worried. Even Tesla, which is run by Trump's sidekick Elon Musk, sent the administration a letter urging it to ease up. That's good advice for us too. The worst trade barriers we face are the regulations and subsidies that differ from EU country to EU country. Eliminating these impediments to intra-European trade might be the only way, for the time being, to confront the madness in Washington. Time will do the rest, said Bart Eckhout in De Morgen, Belgium. In 1930, President Herbert Hoover signed high import tariffs to help U.S. farmers and wound up supercharging the Great Depression. Trump is flinging tariffs like he's throwing darts at a board, creating uncertainty, raising business costs, and tanking stocks. When this hits the bank accounts of his powerful sponsors, internal pressure will force him to back down. There will be no time for Schadenfreude then. Europe will have to pick up the pieces, with or without our former ally and protector. Talking points. 5 years on, how COVID changed everything. When COVID-19 was declared a pandemic 5 years ago, it triggered a brief moment of radical unity, said Janelle Nanos in the Boston Globe. Huddled in our homes, we rallied as the virus swept our communities and gasping victims flooded emergency rooms. We sewed masks, looked out for neighbors, and celebrated first responders and frontline workers. As the grim toll mounted, at one point more than 4,000 Americans were dying every day from COVID, our political leaders made enormous investments in those in need, bailing out entire industries and sending $1,200 checks to nearly everyone, no questions asked. Meanwhile, scientists developed a vaccine at record speed, and some of us wept with joy as the first shot went in our arms. Political polarization dropped as a common foe brought us together. Then it all unraveled. The pandemic cleaved the nation into two distinct camps, said Kavita Patel in MSNBC.com. In one were those who embraced public health mandates and collective responsibility. They masked, shunned gatherings, and lined up for vaccines. In the other were those who dismissed the virus's dangers as overblown, saying personal liberty is paramount, and rebelled against mandates. Our experts gave them reason for wariness, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. Mistakes were made, many understandable in the face of a novel threat, but others a result of political influence. The CDC let teachers' unions sway its recommendations on school closures, even as evidence mounted of how remote learning hurt children. And when the George Floyd killing sparked mass protest, public health officials suddenly stopped telling us to avoid crowds. If the pandemic split society in two, it's clear which side triumphed, said David Frum in The Atlantic. America's top vaccine foe, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., now runs Health and Human Services, and the National Institutes of Health could soon be led by Jay Bhattacharya, who wanted to let COVID spread unchecked to encourage herd immunity. We seem to have collectively forgotten COVID's horrors, said Kate Cohen in the Washington Post. This virus killed at least 7 million worldwide, including 1.2 million Americans, and left millions more with long COVID. As a society, we're living with other long-term damage, higher housing prices, a youth mental health crisis, chronic mistrust of experts. If a true pandemic reckoning will come only when we're certain it's all over, then we're still waiting. Schumer, did he betray the Democrats? Chuck Schumer committed the grave sin of accepting reality, said Brendan Buck in the New York Times, and his party is now furious. The Senate minority leader is facing his Democratic colleagues' ire after he and 9 establishment colleagues voted yes last week to pass the House Republicans' 6-month stopgap funding bill, which prevented an imminent government shutdown. Many House and Senate Democrats who want to try to block President Trump's agenda at any cost are questioning his leadership. In the House, the progressive champion Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called Schumer's decision a huge slap in the face and a betrayal, and there is talk she'll mount a future primary challenge to Schumer in New York. The progressive wing is spoiling for a fight to solve its morale problem, said Nick Cattagio in the Dispatch. But as Schumer recognized, a government shutdown would have been a gift to Trump. The spectacle would have diverted the public's attention from the severe damage his tariff war is doing to the economy. And a shutdown would have given Elon Musk and his flying monkeys a pretext to dogeify the entire federal bureaucracy, laying off hundreds of thousands of workers who'd never get their jobs back. Schumer had only bad political options, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But that's the Democrats' fault. With Republicans controlling both the House and Senate, Democrats have little leverage other than a Senate filibuster. That's the price of voter backlash against 4 years of progressive governance. The party's frustrated left-wing activists are demanding theater, not strategy, said Noah Rothman in National Review. Indeed, polling shows 80% of Democrats want their leaders to be more combative toward Trump. But the current cast of Democrats cannot give their base what it wants. An already demoralized Democratic base is now wondering where to go from here, said Hayes Brown in MSNBC. The party's favorability rating has cratered to just 29%, its lowest in more than 30 years, as voters lose faith that Democratic leaders can present a viable alternative to Trump or stand up to an aspiring autocrat as he tramples the Constitution. In refusing to use every tool in his power to stop Trump, Schumer has left Democrats wondering if their leaders' warnings about the threat Trump poses to the country will be reflected in their actions. Health and science. Bye-bye butterflies? America's butterflies are vanishing at an alarming rate, according to the most comprehensive analysis to date of the insect's population. The total number of butterflies in the contiguous U.S. dropped 22% between 2000 and 2020, a consequence of shrinking habitats, rising temperatures, and the growing use of toxic pesticides. A third of species experienced significant declines, with 114 falling more than 50%, while only 3% of species showed any gains. Some of the nation's most beloved butterflies are in chronic decline. The Red Admiral is down by 44% and the American Lady by 58%. To get those numbers, the researchers analyzed 76,957 surveys by scientists and amateur bug enthusiasts, in which more than 12 million butterflies were tallied. The stunning declines they recorded could threaten ecosystems in which birds, mammals, and other animals rely on butterflies for food, and plants need them for pollination. The insects are also important crop pollinators and are a key source of pollination for Texas's cotton crop. In just 30 or 40 years, we're talking about losing half the butterflies over a continent, entomologist David Wagner, who wasn't involved in the study, tells CNN.com. The tree of life is being denuded at unprecedented rates. A toxic male survivor. Sex is far from safe for male blue-lined octopuses, reports The Guardian. These diminutive cephalopods, who live in the Pacific Ocean off eastern Australia, are about half as big as the golf ball-sized females of their species. And like other male octopuses, they risk becomes a post-copulation snack for their mates, who need a lot of energy to get through the six-week brooding process. But a new study has found that male blue-lined octopuses have a trick to escape coitus alive. They poison their partners. The sea creatures use a highly potent neurotoxin called tetrodotoxin, also found in pufferfish, to paralyze their prey. Researchers at the University of Queensland observed males injecting a targeted dose of venom into the female's aorta at the start of mating sessions that lasts up to 75 minutes. The immobilized females stopped breathing after about 8 minutes, and their bodies went pale. Mating ended when the females regained control of their arms and pushed the males off, the scientists noted. The females appear to have resistance to tetrodotoxin because none died during sex and they fed normally the next day. And obituaries. The hot rod king who made Hollywood's rides, Gene Winfield, 1927 to 2025. Gene Winfield was the Michelangelo of cars. With paint and a blowtorch, he could turn a nondescript Hulk into a tricked-out masterwork with clean lines and an impeccably smooth painted gradient. In 1960s Hollywood, his vehicles were showpieces all over primetime TV, from the flame-throwing Piranha in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. to the shuttlecraft Galileo for Star Trek. But Winfield poured his true passion into work for private collectors, like the stunning jade idol he created in 1960 by modifying a 1956 Mercury hardtop with handmade fenders and headlights and an integrated TV in the dash, then layering it with gleaming coats of pearl and green. The paint technique became known as the Winfield fade. "I have always liked clean styling," he said in 2011. "I look at something like a grill and I think about how many ways I can change it." Robert Eugene Winfield was raised in Modesto, California, where his parents had moved during the Depression, said the Modesto Bee. After they divorced, his mother started a hamburger restaurant, and Gene worked there from age 10. At 14, he opened his first shop out back, adding frills to an old 1928 Ford Model A coupe. In between stints in both the Navy and the Army, he picked up welding from a Japanese expert while stationed in Tokyo. He took up racing. By his early 20s, he was completely rebuilding cars, reupholstering, repainting, chroming up everything. He would often lop off the top of a car and drop the body a few inches to give it a low, sleek look. When one of his creations appeared on the June 1953 cover of Rod and Custom magazine, Winfield had arrived, said Hot Rod. Hollywood soon came calling, and Winfield crafted cars for show after show. One beauty, his 1965 Reactor, made appearances on Bewitched, Star Trek, Mission Impossible, and Batman, where it was Eartha Kitt's Catmobile. But perhaps his most recognizable cars came later in films, said Variety. These were the 25 vehicles he built for 1982's Blade Runner, including the flying cop cars known as Spinners, that were used to patrol a dystopian future world. While he did little film work after that, he continued transforming clients' cars at his Mojave Desert shop well into his 90s. "When people ask me, when am I going to retire?" he said. "I tell them when they put me in the ground." You've been listening to The Week.
This is Kathy Broughton, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading The Week. Thanks for listening. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast/info/audio/on-demand. You can hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.